Okay, so far, you know, we talked about the problem of, you know, defining and computing these distributions of vacua, these counting distributions, and, you know, what are their general characteristics. And now I'll go on and ask, well, suppose we really had this for string theory, you know, this is a well-defined thing, and some oracle, you know, hands it down to us. What would we actually do with it? And, you know, these are very confusing questions that people in quantum cosmology have been trying to think about for a long time and really come to no agreement about. And so, in a way, it's a little unfortunate that we had to face them, but we seem to have to, and there are some advantages. So, what do we say? Okay, so the first thing to say, okay, so you can make some sort of scheme. Obviously, the first thing you would say is, well, you know, surely all these possible vacua are not, you know, equally likely. You know, something in cosmology or something else, you know, favors some vacua over others. And on some very, very vague level, I would agree. But I would immediately kind of, we could go on a very lengthy philosophical discussion. Okay, so I was very careful never to say likely and make a definition which is not a probability distribution. So a probability distribution would be to take this thing and at the very least, you know, divide by the number of vacua or do something that makes the total measure 1. And this definitely does not have this property unless there's only one vacuum, which is presumably not the case. And so rather this is a counting distribution which characterizes where the vacua are. Okay, so how would you, could you make predictions just from this? If not, how would you incorporate additional information? Okay, well, the first point, which I think is important and, you know, trivial in some ways, but sufficiently important to spend some time on, is that under some assumptions for how this function comes out, you can make predictions without any further assumptions about probabilities or cosmology or anything else. And, you know, it's clear if this had been, you know, if the integral had been 1, you wouldn't disagree with me. Now, suppose the integral of this, the total number of vacua, so the sort of favorable number of vacua for which this might be possible is roughly in this kind of range, 10 to the 100 to 10 to the 500. Okay, where do these numbers come from? They come from comparing this roughly 10 to the 240 that I told you about before. If you just had this hypothetical uniform population of models, how many would just match the standard model statistically? Okay, so now what's the idea? Okay, well, we you know, this is the same information as some big set of effective field theories. We, in principle, want to go through each one and just match the observations. And obviously, a primary observation from this point of view is lambda. Okay, well, we can't compute lambda for any given vacuum, right? It's just, you know, unbelievably difficult to compute it to the precision that we need. But we can characterize this distribution of lambdas, and we can imagine using this, integrating over some, you know, different regions in theory space, T1 and T2. Let's take two cases of possible interest. T1 is where the hierarchy problem, the small value of the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, was explained by low-energy supersymmetry. And T2 is where it's not explained by low-energy supersymmetry, or maybe there's some more specific high-energy supersymmetry or other class of models. Okay, so now, you know, these are observable things, and so we could formulate those questions in these regions of theory space that fall into these two classes. Now, suppose we do the counting and integrate, and we find that within this region there are 10 to 140 vacua, and within this region there are 10 to the 80 vacua. Okay, well, I would claim that this is a pretty good argument that string theory predicts low-energy supersymmetry without making any further assumptions and not talking about probabilities. Okay, so we're talking about them in a precise sense, which I'll perhaps, you know, get to. But you know. Okay, so suppose we grant all these assumptions, which I will freely grant based on precedent evidence, are very, very optimistic, but let's grant them. Okay, that we have a theories of, you know, low-energy supersymmetry solving the hierarchy problem. There are 10 to 140 such vacua. They match the standard model in all their ways, but not necessarily lambda. Okay, theory class 2 presumably doesn't have, you know, doesn't have low energy supersymmetry, also matches the standard model except for lambda. Okay, well, now we compute and we establish that the distribution of lambda within these classes is roughly uniform. We vary all these different choices, especially in the hidden sector that we don't see directly. They all make quasi-random contributions to the vacuum energy, and they populate this discretum of theories pretty uniformly. So within this class of theories, it's a good bet that you can realize values of lambda as small as 10 to the minus 140 within this class of theories, unless there's some further structure that you don't know about. You know, there might be some very special theory in there, but in the absence of that, the minimum would be 10 to the minus 80, and assuming that the scale is set by the Planck scale. Let's assume that for this argument. Okay, well, now we know we have to match 10 to the minus 120, and given what we know, it's a reasonable bet that there are such vacua here. It's a reasonable bet that there are not such vacua here. And since we have an assumption under which the theory matches the data, and we have a competing hypothesis under which the theory seems not to match the data, that's pretty good evidence that the theory will work only this under this assumption. If we then go on to discover that we're in this class of models, that's really evidence against string theory. Of course, it might be evidence that any of our other assumptions are wrong. It might be that discounting is wrong. It might be that one of these vacua has some special mechanism and so forth. There were a lot of assumptions in there. But at least we got to a point where we could literally falsify this collection of assumptions, and that can give us evidence against the theory. And ultimately, when you talk about prediction, okay, there are sort of two types. You know, there's the, sometimes I say prediction with a small p, like large extra dimensions. You know, it's just very dramatic and significant if you see it, but there's no argument within the theory that you're going to see it, which doesn't mean you shouldn't look for it, but if you don't see it, that's not evidence against the theory. Yeah?
Once we're talking about predictions, can you summarize for us concrete correlations that occur so far in the landscape?
Well, okay, let me get to that at the end. I mean, there's nothing which is so well established that I would bet my house or anything significant on it, you know. But I can certainly tell you the sorts of things that people. Oh, well, people definitely have thought, you know, me, for example, on this question of low versus high supersymmetry. I'm sorry?
Yeah, this is just one example. Can you explain what?
Oh, okay, another example. I tend to think that let's see, other things I've thought about lately. I mean, there's this question of whether the distribution grows with the volume of the extra dimensions, that if you took it at face value and so forth, would suggest large extra dimensions. It could equally well suggest evidence for selection mechanisms, as I'll get into. There's arguments which I haven't seen the details of, but I'm told by several people out in the West Coast, Scott Thomas and Michael Dine and others, that suggest that within this class of models, you get a peaking for the value of the actual Higgs mass around 170 or 180 GeV when you feed in details of the renormalization group running. No. I mean, we don't know. I mean, it's claimed to be based on fairly general, you know, things like, you know, RG approximate fixed points, you know, when you run down from high energy. So it may not be ridiculously specific. I've kind of switched away from this for the last few months, so I have to think back. But a primary question over here, besides this, you know, first one of supersymmetry, is whether you expect the split supersymmetry versus seeing nothing versus some other type of extra particle. So do you expect the gay genos and fermions to be light? There's definitely a class of questions about the correlation between observed cosmological scales and what we see now. So is inflation preferably up at 10 to the 15 GeV? You know, is this one intuition? And you can come up with some arguments about this distribution effective potentials that support that, versus preferably at very low scales, which, of course, the cosmologists would not like so much. You know, and there are other, you know, it depends on the distribution of inflationary potentials, you know, and if they see anything about the minimum or about the mechanism that makes them. You could imagine making a definite prediction about that. So let's see, what else? This question about exotics. Okay, so we didn't get very far. It might turn out. Oh, here's a very good one. This is one which I've tried to think about. It may be within the range of, you know, kind of what we can do in a next year or something, is does string theory really favor grand unification or not? Okay, so the original heterotic scenario certainly seemed to. The more recent brain construction seemed not to. It seems like it's very, very easy to realize the standard model on brains in a way that does not naturally unify. Which type of construction is favored? This is obviously of very central importance and could correlate with other things. Are there those enough? Okay, so. Speak up.
These numbers you're quoting are
No, no, I'm just trying, again, I'm making a almost metaphysical discussion, but suppose we could control, make some believable statement about the total distribution. Okay. Then really get total numbers. Because I'm controlling properties of the observables or of the effective theory. So this makes sense as a statement about all the vacuum. Yeah. And I agree. I don't know how to make very believable statements about this thing. But to the extent that it's well-defined, I think this is a something we could hope to get someday. And this is a good way to think about these problems. Okay, so this is a favorable case where you can get a pretty strong prediction without any further assumptions. Now, it is in a sense a probabilistic prediction, but what the sense of probability that one's talking about is a purely theoretical sense. It's a sense of our uncertainty about the theories we're talking about. It's nothing about the probability of our universe or something like that, which I personally think is meaningless. This is a unique event. It's really, you can't use the frequentist definition of probability when you talk about a unique event. But there are many other definitions of probability that the quantum cosmologists have been forced to in thinking about these things. And there's another standard one called the subjectivist interpretation, where probability is entirely expressing your own degree of knowledge and confidence about the various alternatives, and in this case, the various possible alternative theories which are available to you to explain the data. And in this case, what we were saying, we could make more precise, is that it's very improbable that a theory out of this class matches the cosmological constant. If we had to do it by further fine-tuning, it's improbable at the level 10 to the minus 40. But that's reflecting our beliefs and knowledge about the situation. Maybe one actually does it, but it is an accurate reflection of the knowledge that went in. Okay, so you can imagine, many variations of this, and as you talk about things which are more less and less natural within string theory, meaning that are satisfied by fewer and fewer vacua, you can, obviously the thing I just said, if the total number of vacua is 10 to the 500, this is rather implausible. We take away the, the 10 to the 120 or so for the standard model, and the numbers are much bigger than this. But now, you can still talk about things which are far more implausible. So an example is time variation of the fine structure constant. So time variation of the fine structure constant was, of course, suggested by certain astrophysical observations of quasars, which most people don't believe, but the original authors haven't literally taken back. And it's not, contradicted by any fundamental principle. Now, you can model that within string theory, but only if the effective potential as a function of the fine structure constant is exceedingly flat, so that you can have variation of whatever scalar field controls the fine structure constant over cosmological timescales. And there's no mechanism to do that down on this scalar cosmological constant. So now what you're asking for is something that not just solves the cosmological constant problem, but solves it parametrically over this range of, say 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 fractional variation of alpha. And if you look at this, you find that you have to tune something like 7 or 8 coefficients of the Taylor experiment. So this is sort of the best case for this argument, because we know there are lots of contributions to the vacuum energy that goes alpha and alpha squared and alpha cubed. So these coefficients are big, and you have to add extra stuff to tune them away. But in principle, you could cook up a model that did it. So if you say that the scale is controlled by the supersymmetry breaking scale, so that in terms of the supersymmetry breaking scale, just to be more favorable, the effective potential is about 10 to the minus 60 instead of 10 to the minus 20, you have to tune about 6 coefficients. So you find that the difficulty of doing this, and you justify this uniform distribution, about 10 to the minus 480. Okay, so even this kind of number, there are not enough vacua to get this. Seeing this, I would really regard as evidence, powerful evidence against our present understanding of string theory. Yeah?
Sorry, just to clarify, you're doing this discussion using relative distributions, relative probabilities comparing...
They're not probabilities. They're not probabilities. They are numbers of models within a certain class.
But these are relative numbers.
Relative to what?
Relative to the causal number
no.
overall.
No. The under this definition, you know, it doesn't matter how many other ones there are. If I control the distribution and I integrate it over there, I don't need to know what it is over there. I'm not dividing through by anything. But by relative, yes, I'm always comparing different theory classes to really make a sharp statement. I'm saying that the number in this relative to this, you know, is larger than specific. But the statement is, you know, the number fitting everything. Okay, so really, I artificially separate out the cosmological constant. If we treat all the parameters on equal footing, then the claim is that in a given region, you know, is in fact, you know, much less than one, order than one, much greater than one. That's the interesting statement. Which is not relative to anything.
What if there exists some region which is not part of the experimentally given bounds, for instance, cosmological constant,
right.
10 to the minus 100?
Right.
But then number of vacuum in that region is something like 10 to the 10 million.
Yeah, no, I would say if you believe your analysis that says, well, see, it's implausible. I mean, first of all, the first thing I would say is it's very implausible that there's a set of 10 to the 10 million vacua, all of whose cosmological constant is greater than 10 to the minus 100. I just cannot imagine how that would happen. Now, you might construct such a thing, and if you find compelling evidence that, yes, that's how it works, there's some mechanism that pushes all the cosmological constants up above that, I would say, well, yeah, they're all ruled out. Yeah, just because there are many of them doesn't make them any more fitting the data.
So the sense in which you're using probability here is in the sense of lack of control in the explicit.
That's right. That's, well, now we can introduce other ideas. Now we will go on. We can of course introduce other ideas of probability, but right. So far that's all I'm using.
But if somebody,
right.
With a brilliant theory comes up.
That's right. If we really had this is a sum of delta functions,
no,
and if we had the sum of delta functions,
or not,
that's right. Exactly. At this level, that's what we're doing.
So
that's right. You could in principle measure out to alpha to 100
so
places
this
and find that
is there a current level of lack of.
That's right. So far, that's the sense of probability. Now we can put in other ones, but so far in the discussion, that's the one we're using. That's right. Okay, and then this is the what it's founded on is this absolute number of vacua that agree, you know, with a certain set of data, and, you know, of course, assumptions about how we interpret the data. Okay, so even this fantastically unlikely thing, of course, if there are 10,000 vacua, you know, it's hardly ruled out at all. You know, it's easy to match in string theory. Okay, so that I think illustrates the point, and now we can go on to say, I mean, we don't know. Okay, so the current estimates from just counting, you know, naively counting numbers of cycles and numbers of fluxes and the sorts of formulas I talked about range anywhere from the low end of 10 to the 500 to 10 to the, I don't know, 3,000. Is that what you quoted, Frederick, for math theory? Anyhow, this is, you know, like, you know, Calabi-Yau's with, you know, 480, you know, B21, you know, chi equals 960, and Busso-Polchinski type of, you know, estimate. And assuming that this volume of the moduli space is not extremely small, which is not inconceivable, and all the way up to the numbers of cycles on fourfolds and you know, various assumptions about the discussion. And so this is kind of the upper end of any sort of purely statistical predictivity, and this is certainly far beyond it. So that's one motivation for looking for additional information beyond what I just put in. Okay, so now, yeah, where could that come from? Okay, well, the obvious place to look is cosmology. Now, again, there are sort of two things you can, well, there's no clean separation. Let me just outline how you might try to bring in cosmological considerations, okay? Because, you know, based on present understanding, there's this sort of story that is, I think, in the back of people's minds, where you start off with some sort of wave function at the Planck scale. Before that point, there's no real idea of geometry. Everything is interfering with everything else. Maybe it doesn't even exist in string theory. The time is before the Planck time. But somewhere at the Planck time, you cross over to some slightly more semi-classical description, and you can make sense of this wave function of geometries and other data. Okay, now it has to go through various stages of inflation. And we now have this strong observational, not evidence that inflation did take place at some scale, V, which was at most 10 to the 15 JeV, and density fluctuations were 10 to the minus 5. Now, there could have been previous stages of inflation. at higher scales, okay, and then this could also be all the way down to, who knows, you know, 1 TeV, 10 TeV. Okay, but anyhow, you go through this regime of slow roll inflation, and then you roll down this effective potential, and you reheat, and you end up in some minimum, and from a given type of inflation, you know, some particular region of this configuration space, you could roll down into various minima. So that's sort of dynamics. You know, and then finally, there's the other, you know, the more standard phenomenological and also implicitly, I've avoided using the word, but, you know, anthropic constraints. You know, there are all sorts of understood possible extra dynamics, particles, ... that can screw you up at this point and make you disagree with observations. And this one, you know, certainly falls within the standard phenomenological considerations, and to a large extent, this one and this one. Okay, and then people are less sure to say about what to say about those. Now, there's a particularly interesting version of this, which is known as eternal inflation. That basically starts from the observation that given a certain condition on the potentialized derivatives, which basically corresponds to the condition that the expected density fluctuations would have been by order one, you find that there's a significant probability for the scalar field in inflation to roll up. Okay, so normally you have this you know, friction-like rolling of the scalar fields in inflation, and then you superimpose on that. So phi dot is some minus, you know, h v prime, and now you can superimpose on that some sort of quantum jumps. Okay, so you follow the universe for one Hubble time, inverse Hubble time. It blows up in each dimension by a factor of e, and so it blows up, one causal region blows up into roughly 20 causal regions, and each of these, the expected value of the scalar field is governed by the expectation of this equation, but the actual value of the scalar in each of these regions can differ by these quantum jumps. Okay, so you find that if the density fluctuations is sufficiently large, sometimes you can roll back up. Sometimes the delta phi dominates the v prime, and you find that out of these regions, some of them, actually roughly about three, it's a Gaussian, so it's a sort of universal, have a larger value of v than you started with. And then those guys won't, you know, they may continue to roll down, but now these guys will continue to repeat this process, and you'll get an infinite sequence of inflations. Okay, so it's a weird possibility, which is not at all clear what it has to do with any observation, because this is not the inflation we see, which has that property. But what it does do is it, first of all, provides a way to populate this huge landscape, so it solves one of the objections you might have made to, you know, and obviously if the initial dynamics only populates a few vacua, you know, then you can forget about all the others right there. But this provides a mechanism for the set of possible universes, causal regions, to explore this bigger landscape. And it has, yeah.
Is that clear? I mean, just because you...
It requires the configuration space now to be connected. Obviously, if it's disconnected at any point, then you don't explore it. And that's something that we really have no clue about at this point.
Is it clear that you wouldn't, even if you had this, that you wouldn't have, that you would actually be exploring, that you wouldn't be restricted to a very special point?
Well, no, let me get to the interesting statement of that sort. I'm, again, just kind of summarizing very loosely thoughts of Linde, Guth, Vilenkin, and others, and you should look at their reviews. But the you know, this dynamic clearly does, you know, if you look at it, you know, it does wander around. It provides ways to move around through an entire connected piece of the configuration space. And I agree, we don't know how much is connected. Now, you know, of course, even if we, you know, granting this proviso, if it were disconnected, how do we a priori know which connected component we live in? But anyhow, leaving those slides aside, now the point that has been made by some of these people, and which Guth in particular has been studying for quite a while, is that suppose you imagine this process as producing from one some huge number of causal regions. Now you could try to ask, well, now at some late time, what is the number of each of these causal regions that sits in a given minimum? Okay, and how do you compute that? Well, basically you have to follow this complicated effective scalar field trajectory for each one, and you want to know from how many of those causal regions did you create. That's basically the total expansion factor integrated along this whole thing, and it's in fact dominated by the expansion at whatever is the maximum point on the potential. Okay, so let's grant that, it's sort of unbelievable at first, but let's grant that there's some actual maximum of this. First of all, that we can think in effective potential at all on this regime, and then it has some maximum. Well, the rough statement is that in each inverse Hubble time, inverse of that effective potential, you multiply the number of universes of this type by 3. So very rapidly, whatever is the maximum will overwhelmingly dominate this numerical distribution of possible vacua among these causal regions. So you'll very quickly be forced to histories where you start out at this maximum V max and then roll down to something near it. Okay, so this has been advocated as a possible selection principle. Okay, so one thing which logically belongs in the prior discussion, and I kind of skipped it because it's even less clear, but it has to be part of this discussion, is that once you start talking about probabilities, it's first, there are many wave functions, there are many probability assignments which are not highly peaked. Okay, so let's say that there is some P measure on the space of vacuum, which really is a probability distribution. Okay, well again, now what is this rough character? It could, on the one extreme, be uniform for everybody, or it might be extremely sharply peaked, or it might be somewhere in the middle. Suppose, nvac is 10 to the 1,000, we find another guy which is 10 to the 10 minus 1,010. Okay, well, by some standard rules of probability, you might land on this guy and say that it's disfavored by an amount, 10 to the minus 10 compared to the others. But this is obviously carrying the belief and interpretation of this probability to an absurd extreme. And I could, if I'm going to talk about this, I could come up with much more weird paradoxes about this. Basically, the usefulness of this probability distribution depends very much on it being much more sharply peaked than this. Okay, and so now coming back to eternal inflation, the thing I just described has a chance of being incredibly sharply peaked. It's basically exponential of this inverse Hubble. So inverse of so there's this fictitious number of times that you've evolved, and it would be e to the plus that number of times the over the Hubble time. And this can be as sharply peaked as you like. Okay, so from this,
probability distribution you get from the detailed Barras type
algorithm? No. Okay, I don't think so. Well, let me come back to this guy. Okay, so let me first of all state the standard ejection against this one. Okay, so the standard ejection against this one. Okay, there's a non-standard ejection, which is implicit and which I've tried to work on, which is that surely this claim that there's a maximum of the potential is at best suspicious, but it is the sort of thing that you could try to justify from string theory, that there's some maximum rate of inflation, like the other sorts of speed limits that Silverstein and collaborators have discussed. And of course, there are many analogies. And there is a case where you can convincingly argue that there's a maximum, which is just to say that suppose you can understand inflation in weakly coupled string theory, well, an inflationary regime, the expansion is close, very similar to the sitter locally. The sitter space has a temperature, roughly this this Hubble scale. And then given that you have a temperature, well, for sufficiently high temperature, there will be a Hagedorn transition where you necessarily produce a tachyon. So as that temperature goes above the string scale, you will universally get a tachyon and you roll back down out of inflation. So according to these intuitive arguments, the maximum rate of inflation in weakly coupled string theory is the string scale. Okay, and so that's a maximum. And on the other hand, it's a maximum which only works in weakly coupled string theory. If you crank up the coupling, of course, the string scale differs by a fractional power of decoupling from the Planck scale. At order one, this becomes a maximum rate of inflation at the Planck scale, which is certainly what you would guess a priori. If there's any maximum, it's at the Planck scale. And so it's consistent with that, and now you have to argue more generally that there's such a bound, and I have no idea how to do that. So that's the objection that you might address from string theory. Now, there's a second objection which says that making precise sense of this numerical distribution requires drawing a time slice and counting the vacua, the different causal regions on that time slice. And if you look at the type of causal structures you get out of this, it's horribly fractally complicated and diverse, and depending on the time slice you draw, you'll get totally different answers. And nobody's ever come up with an unambiguous way to, you know, describe the result of making this prescription. And Vilenkin is the one who has tried hardest, and I hope I'm not being unfair, but I think it's accurate to say that he has solved his objections, you know, more than once, and then realized that, well, no, here's a further problem, or, you know, here's why it doesn't solve the problem. So he's thought very hard about this, and it's unclear. Okay, now, why did I spend so much time talking about 1A instead of what would seem primary, which is 1? And I think I was unfair, because 1 is logically primary. Okay, so there could be an initial wave function. Of course, there's the Hartle-Hawking class of wave function, which perhaps other people have talked about here, that in semi-classical gravity you can integrate over Euclidean manifolds which are bounded by a possible free geometry. You get a natural wing factor, which in some caricature sense is e to the plus 1 over lambda, or e to the plus 1 over, again, b effective, okay, measured in Planck units. Okay, so that's a fairly clear sort of proposal for the probability distribution, at least you would think at first. Now, my excuse for not starting with that guy is that to the extent you believe in 1A, eternal inflation, it totally washes out any knowledge of this. You know, it doesn't really matter how the starting point is distributed. You have to now go through this stochastic dynamics. But again, we don't know. You know, maybe this isn't there. This is, again, the standard thing which the cosmologists, you know, Linde, Vilenkin, and so forth will say. But let's come back to this guy. Let's say maybe this doesn't happen. Okay, well, now you think about this. Okay, now early on there was this kind of dispute over whether the continuation in this Euclidean functional integral is done right. Maybe it's a minus. It's generally agreed that the answer is a plus. And this is for going off into some positive cosmological constant de Sitter space. But now, in interpreting this, you have to ask, well, what is the V effective? Is it the V effective now? Is it the V effective in early cosmology? Is it the V effective in some distant future? Okay, what is it? And the standard answer to this question, again, I should hesitate before saying this, but certainly what you'll read in most of the literature is that this process describes a tunneling event out, again, to an inflationary regime of this general type. You're at some saddle point of the effective potential. This is the value of the effective potential at the saddle point. Then, you know, if you satisfy these slow roll constraints, you'll roll down, and the story continues from there. And that makes a certain sense to it. You would expect that such a, you know, general thing as the wave function of the universe couldn't possibly describe the whole future evolution of the universe. It must describe something about the early universe. Okay, and then the standard thing to say about this is that, well, this is manifestly wrong, okay, because what does this do? This gives us a direct prediction of the scale of inflation. It tells us that the scale of inflation is as small as it can possibly be. Okay, so now we have these, you know, phenomenological bounds, as I said, you know, it's hard to get it below, you know, 1/10 TeV or something. And it's very difficult to believe that string theory doesn't allow pushing the scale of inflation below that. Oh, yeah, you could propose other wave functions. I'm talking about Hartle-Hawking. Well, we're granting, of course, that, you know, that there's some not preferred, or, you know, we're going to assume at least. So you know, once we do this, we're going to start saying that we weigh all of our things by this. And now I'm going to make predictions under the joint assumption that I have string theory with the Hartle-Hawking wave function. And now clearly it should be much more selective than what I said before. There'll be lots of vacua we just throw out. Right, so that's good from that point of view, but not to the extent that you immediately contradict the observation. And this is the standard comment.
What I mean is that the Vilenkin condition
would take that as the maximum. What would you say? Actually, Hartle-Hawking. Oh, you mean the, you want to talk about the minus versus the plus? So I wrote plus, Hartle-Hawking. You say maybe we did it wrong and there's a minus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, I see, in the general, so if you try to derive it, people, including Vilenkin and Linde, agree that that's incorrect. But I would agree to the philosophy that says that anything which is well-defined, you know, any probability distribution you can give me which is well-defined deserves consideration. so hard to prove these things. It's sort of metaphysical to prove them. Anything is well, maybe it's just as well defined. The problem with this one is that it's not highly peaked. Okay, so this guy peaks up towards the Planck scale, where the exponents are already of order one. Suppose you can get above the Planck scale, the exponent goes towards zero. All those guys are of order one. Okay, so it's just not highly peaked. It's not selective among that large class of vacuum. So it's interesting, but it doesn't really help you. And it, of course, you would have to now. There's this further problem which Todd has emphasized in his work, which says that the ideal thing clearly would solve these problems and peak on the 10 to the minus 5. And maybe subleading corrections to this calculation will produce a more interesting function that peaks at some intermediate value. And he has some arguments which support that, which at this stage, again, are universally disbelieved by others. But I'm not going to do more than report my, what I've gotten from talking to the people. So that's an interesting possibility. There's some function of maybe VFF, the effect of maybe other parameters. In an early version of his work, volume of the extra dimensions, although Tai has stepped back from that, that turns out to be highly peaked. That would be much more interesting, I quite agree. But as it stands, these guys suffer from the failings I described. Now, I should report that this doesn't seem to be Linde's interpretation of this function. He says that the V effective is supposed to be the cosmological constant at very late times. Okay, and when he told me this, I didn't have the wit to make the response, which is to say, well, you wrote a paper where you claim that the potential looks like this. There's a very small lambda in a potential well, and then there's a tunneling event out to 10 flat dimensions and zero. So which VF do you mean? Why do you mean this one and not this one? Okay, so I don't think that is well defined at present what he says. But if you nevertheless grant it and say that, it's the VF now, for some reason we ignore what's going on over there, then this definitely makes a sharp prediction. We are in the lowest possible, let's say, positive cosmological constant. So at first that sounds great. It's a very highly peaked until you realize what it means. It means that to find the right vacuum, you have to calculate the cosmological constant to at least 10 to the minus 122 precision. You have to go through all the vacua and find the one for which it's the smallest. Okay? And, mathematically, probably a very well-defined problem once we formulate string theory. Practically, a totally impossible problem. There's just no hope of computing anywhere like that precision. And if we really believed in that proposal, I think we would immediately, very quickly, be forced back into just having to work with this because we don't know. We can't do the calculation to derive that weighing function. All we can say is that we have answered this question of why the effective cosmological constant is small. Now there's one interesting thing to check if you believe that, which is to say that I think this would make the sharp prediction that the number of the sitter vacua, which make any sense at all, for which this proposal applies, has to be of order 10 to the 122. If the observed cosmological constant, if the expansion universe is due to cosmological constant, is the factor that sits in here. Well, if there were candidate vacua that had much less than 10 to the minus 122, then we would have to live in it because it is wave function. And conversely, because we measure, presumably, lambda, the number of vacua has to be about this order. So in a sense, that would be a very striking piece of evidence for this. Again, one which we're farther, not close to getting at present, but at least is well-defined
but
according to...
assuming a uniform distribution.
No, it's not. It's assuming this distribution. I'm saying that, again...
There could be large numbers of vacua with much bigger...
Oh, you're right. You have a uniform distribution of lambda around this region zero. Yeah, you're right. But that's right. That could fail. But that there are such simple arguments lead to uniform distribution for the cosmological constant. Just this basic statistical argument that you're just adding uncorrelated contributions. I agree. It could fail that way. You might try to reconcile the things that way. But I personally believe the uniform distribution of the cosmological constant has much simpler arguments than most of the other things we're talking about. Okay, so it remains to be seen. So, it's worth exploring these things, and I think I've indicated some of the issues in trying to use them. It's worth exploring this one. It's even more worth exploring this one because it hasn't been established that just matching the observational constraints on inflation within string theory is easy. I mean, the sense is that just getting the slow roll in this is not hard. Okay, just there's some field up there, and... in itself, getting that field to satisfy the conditions for a one field potential is just a matter of some relatively small fine-tuning. Okay, now the only hard part of the problem is getting rid of all the other candidate tachyons. Okay, and that's what people spend all their effort in doing. And it shares something. It's sort of a more difficult version of this vacuum stabilization problem. The evidence so far is that it's technically hard, but there are many solutions. We don't know. Anyhow, it could be that that or other observational constraints on inflation will turn out to help us very much here. And this one is interesting to the extent that you think that there's something going on here. Again, so what is this step giving you? This step is basically giving you, given some starting point, some space of set within the space of possible initial conditions, phi, its derivatives and so forth, its time derivatives. There's various probabilities you could derive for rolling down, which has all sorts of interesting structure, depends on the shape of the potential, might depend on enhanced symmetries that you see along the way. So there's this interesting function that you would convolve with the functions up here. Okay, and so the extreme version of the eternal inflation, it may be of this, is that there's a preferred starting point up here, and all the structure is then the different probabilities of rolling down to the different vacuums. So in some sense, you're near this. Do we know that that's sharply picked? Okay, well, we do not know that that's sharply picked. Okay, I mean, it could be that the effective space in which you're moving is so high dimensional that many, many vacua are easy to reach by rolling down. So that's much more in the class of problems where you can study it by effective field theory and the structure of the potentials we can already talk about. These things, real string theory. The semi-classical language is obviously starting to break down, but this part of the problem we could say more about. We could at least convince ourselves that, yes, if you knew the starting point, that would select among some average n number of vacua, which we hope is much smaller than the total number. So that remains to be established convincingly. Of course, it could be that at this stage, you have no a priori statement about the starting point, and then this one becomes pretty useless. If you start with the uniform distribution and then convolve it with something, it's going to be pretty uniform afterwards. So I think
there could be
a very strong attractor. I won't... My sense is that that's not going to be as sharply peaked as what you want up here, but it's certainly worth looking for. And analogous problem, spin glasses and Kinner's matter and so forth, you don't have that kind of strong attracting behavior. But I agree, that's worth looking for too. So so what can I say? I apologize for the crudity of this discussion, but again, it's just some very bare bones outline of what's already been a fairly active topic of research, and I haven't concentrated on it in my past work. And my sense has been that until you know something about the space on which this distribution lives in its basic character, then you wouldn't know what to do with this anyway. Okay, and as I said, it's not totally inconceivable. At the present stage, getting the sort of numbers that don't require you to make this discussion. So as I said, 10 to the 100, even 200 would be very good for the point of view of predictivity, depends on there being many more instabilities in the vacua, or possibly many more dualities that equate what are naively distinct vacua. And an example of such a thing is that In essentially no high-dimensional case has this volume, even of Calabi-Yau moduli space, been computed. Frederick and I were surprised to find that for the Mirquintic, the one-parameter case, we just did it numerically. It's just pi over 5, and this wasn't in the literature. So this is the volume, in the Bay-Patterson metric. So how does it behave for a very high-dimensional Calabi-Yau? Well, you might say it should be order 1, or you might say maybe it's order 1 over n factorial, the volume of a simplex, or even the volume of a very high-dimensional CPM. Okay, so what's the intuition that leads to that? Basically, it's to say that, how are we distinguishing these different vacua anyways? There's no labels on the cycles of the Calabi-Yau. It's all the different values of the periods, or the volumes of the cycles that let us distinguish and say that, so what was the Busel-Polchinski type of picture? You have n cycles, L cycles, we'll say, n fluxes on each cycle, and so you get roughly n to the L. But that assumes that you can distinguish the cycles. Okay, well, how do you distinguish the cycles? All you have topologically is just an intersection form, and you have a huge, you know, SP duality symmetry that lets you exchange sets of cycles. So you cannot distinguish the cycles until you get more information. Now, once you have a point in moduli space, you know the volume of these cycles, and that lets you distinguish them. But that's putting in extra information. Maybe the distance that you travel through the moduli space to exchange these guys is so short, you know, that you're, you know, again, you know, it's reflected in this volume. Maybe this volume is so small that what you think are many distinct vacua are really not, are really very close together. And in the case of, again, probably not a good analogy, but it just mathematically illustrates the possibilities, you know, the volume of PN, you know, it comes out that way. So it's conceivable at this point. I thought we had arguments against this, but I start to doubt them. And it's conceivable that these numbers will be drastically reduced once you understand the dualities and feed in these actual volumes and so forth. That's another hope you can hold out. As I said, physically, you know, many more instabilities is another hope you can hold out and I've tried to think about. So I think we don't know this absolute number. There's quite a bit I could go on to say, but it would be repeating my string sock about why we think this number is finite. But again, I've probably run out of time for now. So let me stop there and open it to discussion. Hiroshi? Yeah.
So maybe you mentioned that accumulate.
Yeah.
But regarding the question of infinite versus finite, there is a work by Wadi Taylor, Shamir.
Yeah, okay, I didn't say it precisely. So the standing, okay, so the basic, so if you don't make some cut on your definition of vacuum, then the number is infinite. And the basic example, which was in, you know, our original work, and you know, this is ADS4 cross S7. So here's you put a flux on the S7 integral of star G in M theory, and then for any positive, you know, any value of this N, you have a vacuum. So there's clearly an infinite number of four-dimensional vacua. Now, why is this not a problem? Because the volume of the S7 grows with N, and eventually, as N becomes large, Kaluza-Klein states will come down, and this theory will not be effectively four-dimensional. It would contradict even experiments about the inverse square law of gravity. And so to rule out this sort of thing, because there's no indication that this phenomenon has to do with special properties of your ADS or supersymmetry of any of ES, the standard conjecture, which I put in my first paper, is number of vacua is finite if we put upper bound on the volume, and we put a upper bound on some value of the actual cosmological constant. This one is a little bit more artificial.
What about rather than lower bound?
Here. No, I don't think there's any a priori. You worry about this.
Right.
Yeah, I think in the paper I said it this way. The case for this is a little bit more indirect. It says that if you had a sequence running off to minus, then you could very likely add energy and fluxes to push it back up to zero. So you would almost certainly falsify even with this bound. The reason for putting this one is also a little indirect, because you might say, well, these guys obviously contradict observation as well. But the point is that there are all sorts of instabilities which we know are there, but we don't control too well. So the basic example of another series of infinite series of vacua is take, you know, your favorite KKLT and add N D3 dark pair and start pushing the D3 bars far away from the D3s and the fluxes. Okay, well, this is a potential infinite series which had better become unstable at this point. Indeed, there are papers arguing that this does become unstable, but it's not precise enough to base your considerations. And a more crude way to put this in is just to say this adds, you know, 2 times the tension, you know, eventually you'll violate this. And pretty generally, you know, things like this that produce an infinite series by breaking supersymmetry by arbitrarily large amounts will eventually violate this. So this was a crude way of incorporating this instability bound. So as I reported in strings, well, the, you know, DeWolf et al. And I should say Acharya et al. Established you know, generalizations of this series that have a faster growth of the number of vacua with volume. Don't contradict this. Rather, what they do is they suggest that the number of vacua could grow with the volume dramatically, in principle as high as some, you know, 2/3 times the number of cycles being the power in the 2A DeWolf et al. Construction. And this, again, they don't make a big point of this in this paper, because you would have to argue further to argue that you could use these for realistic models. But I don't see the obvious argument that you can't. And so what this says is that, this is quite optimistic to think that these numbers of vacua are so small that you would immediately be in this regime. What's the phenomenological band on this volume? If you're very optimistic, if you really read the phenomenological papers, it's again around the order 10 to EV from close to quantum radiation from supernovas. So that's about 10 to the 15 in Planck units. And so this is obviously a huge growth in the number of all vacua. This is the expected number at very large extra dimensions compared to the expected number of string scale extra dimensions. And if, again, you took this at face value, you get a very exciting prediction. It would be great if we discovered large extra dimensions, but it's too good to be true, obviously. And what I at least suggested in the strings is that we might instead regard this as evidence that there is a selection effect which contains a factor that looks kind of like this, which was in the early form of Tai's proposal, for example. Although, as I mentioned, I think he stepped back from claiming that this comes out. But this is, so there's another, the thing where, this interacts very directly with the selection, of course, is that you might have hoped that at least, ratios between these numbers would be meaningful. But to the extent that the selection factor depends on observables, then obviously that's very misleading. Now, you just now have to decide based on what you think the selection effect is. Does this depend on the parameter of interest or not? Okay, so like you're trying to explain three generations. Well, it's very, very implausible that any of these factors depend directly on three generations. Okay, but volume of the extra dimensions, it seems very plausible a priori. There are arguments you can make that the selection factor depends on that. So the selection factor is certainly very important, but it depends on the question that you ask, whether it's the key to the problem or some relatively minor consideration. And I would read this at the present day as a reason to look for such selection effects. It doesn't prove that they're there, but it's a reason to look for them. Okay, but the status of this conjecture is that the things in the literature which really you read them and they suggest counterexamples to this have the sticks. There is no clear counterexample to this.
Given that we have run from this, I'm not going to talk to you. Very nice.
Thanks.